Tak, já myslím, že můžeme začít. Můžeme si na začátku taky rozmyslet, jestli ta přednáška bude v češtině nebo v angličtině, protože pan kolega tady zatím není. Ale na druhou stranu, ono možná z toho bude skládat zkoušku náš doktorant. Takže já asi za chviličku přepnu do angličtiny. Jenom řeknu, že minulou hodinu jsme tady diskutovali na vybraných kapitolách slapové působení mezi tělesy ve sluneční soustavě a myslím, že letos na fyzice malých těles nebudeme tak teda tím pádem podrobně diskutovat slapy v soustavě Země, Měsíc a jako mezi jinými tělesy ve sluneční soustavě, tak na to se když tak budete moct podívat v rámci těch vybraných kapitol, kde jsem se snažil popsat nějaké nové výsledky, které jsme získali pro třeba soustavu měsíců v systému Kleopatra, anebo teďka pracujeme na systému asteroidu 22 Kaliope a jeho měsíce Linus, což je, myslím, největší asteroidální měsíc ve sluneční soustavě. Nepočítám-li Antiope, což jsou dvě srovnatelně velká 90-kilometrová tělesa, tam musí ty slapy být ještě mnohem zajímavější, prostě protože nemůžete vynechat ani ty druhé slapy toho druhého tělesa. Je pravda, že ten systém asi bude možná ze slapového hlediska už synchronizovaný plně, takže ta dvě tělesa asi budou okolo sebe obíhat synchronně, což by do jisté míry ty slapy vypínalo, protože potom když je rotační perioda stejná jako omega, tak to vlastně v řeči těch slapů, co jsme diskutovali minulou hodinu, znamená, že ta rušící frekvence, jak bychom česky řekli loading, zatěžovací frekvence, myslím, od toho sousedního měsíce, by se vlastně blížila nule. Tak to jsme diskutovali minulou hodinu. A dneska bych s vámi rád prodiskutoval srážky asteroidů, respektive systém rovnic, který bychom mohli použít pro popis srážek asteroidů. So, let me switch to English and let me start with a few figures, because sometimes I'm in a hurry and I have no time at the end of the lecture. I think it's sometimes useful to start with the nice figures because it would be a shame not to show something which can be computed by our by the model I'm going to describe. So I think it was this year when we studied one of the small asteroid families in the main belt. It's called the Hobson asteroid family. And it was a very interesting case because as pointed out by my colleague, David Vokrouhlický, it contains a significant asteroid pair. I mean, the first two bodies in this system are of comparable sizes. And so we were, of course, very interested in whether we can create this pair of similarly sized objects at the same time as the family which surrounds this case. So this is one of the animations I wanted to show. It's an animation which runs very slow, I think. I see, because maybe there is some background process, possibly related to Zoom, which slows down this animation. But we are more interested in individual figures. So initially, this impact creates a lot of ejecta. Essentially, the outer shell of this object is ejected, which is a kind of waste of material. But later on, you can see a very systematic behavior in the center of this impact, right? I think it happens at the very center, and it's better to see essentially a narrow cross-section through the center of the body in order to understand the mechanics of material which happens just in the middle. And that's the second dimension. Right? In the second case, you see only a slice through the body. The initial state was this one, right? We had a projectile, like quite a sizable projectile, and a target, more or less spherical. And when the projectile hit the target, the central body was essentially squeezed along one direction, because I think we hit at 45 degrees impact angle. And this creates a very symmetric situation. And essentially, in, let me say, 1/10 of cases, the central body was essentially split into two halves, which appear as prolonged central object in this case. It's a, I think, interesting situation. And I'm going to show equations which we used to describe this hydrodynamic and kind of catastrophic event in this case. Eventually, we have to also account for gravitational reaccumulation. And the reaccumulation in this case is, again, very interesting. It's the initial state is essentially the very end of the hydrodynamic simulation. And we switch, we simply hand off all particles in the hydrodynamic model into individual particles or spheres in an n-body model. And then this is approximately 100,000 spheres. They evolve, they can collide, and they can merge together when they approach and gravitationally attract each other. So what you can see here is, of course, the core, the center of the family. Well, most of small sized spheres escape because they reach the escape velocity, or even more than escape velocity. But what you can see in the center is a pair of objects, which are, well, they are not bound. They are marginally unbound. And they, as a result, they orbit on similar, very similar orbits. Actually, all these fragments, all these sizable fragments, orbit on similar orbits, and they form asteroid family. What you can also see on these figures are a bunch of moons, especially, watch for a tiny binary at the top of this figure. There is a small bound binary which orbits as, I think it's escaping ejecta moon, which was mentioned last week, because it corresponds to a situation where the outgoing particles or ejected particles remain bound with respect to each other. And the fraction of these escaping ejecta binaries is really non-negligible. We can see easily one here and possibly a few others, maybe just below the central body. So that's my goal, to show how to compute these simulations and how to compute them in efficiently enough. As you can imagine, I'm going to start with a set of equations, which I'm going to write on this table. Hopefully the screen resolution will be sufficient so that you will see everything clearly, or you can use eventually the lecture notes where you can see, where you can find this set of equations, of course, in a nicely written form. So just let me. And also, I will have a higher resolution recording later on available on our streaming server. So, what I would like to discuss with you today is a set of equations related to smooth particle hydrodynamics. Or shortly, SPH. Of course, these continuous equations are very general, and you can use them anytime, and you can use them even with other numerical schemes to describe the behavior of asteroids colliding with each other. So first, we have to decide whether we shall use a fixed coordinate frame versus commoving coordinate frame. And it's a very important question. You know, you probably remember these animations, right? Ejecta going everywhere, even up to infinity. So my choice is quite clear. We have to use a commoving frame, or it's also called Lagrangian frame or Lagrangian equations. It means that on the left-hand side, we are going to have total derivatives of our quantities. And we can imagine that we always move together with the medium. It's something that it's actually more similar to the second Newton law, where we have acceleration and force acting on a given body. And so we always watch the body and account for forces acting on the body, but we always focus on the body. In this case, we describe the continuum, but we will follow its evolution and we will commute with the continuum. So my first equation will be quite logical because we already know the equations for the protoplanetary disk, which are written in this fixed or Eulerian coordinate frame. But I'm going to use d rho over dt on the left-hand side, which is equivalent to the left-hand side of the Eulerian equations. So this is the total derivative, which essentially means the partial derivative. Let me take a note here. It's d rho over dt partial plus the advective term or v times gradient acting on rho, which is the former left-hand side, but today we are not going to use it, right? Because it's included in this total derivative. Instead, we have to directly write down the right-hand side, which is, in our case, the expansion of the material, the expansion, which means minus rho times divergence of the velocity field. So please remember this, that we account only for the expansion. Because everything else is included in this total derivative. All right, so the second equation, which is the Navier-Stokes equation. Now this is the equation of continuity, and now we are going to use the Navier-Stokes. Well, again, dv over dt. Okay. Which is, by the way, the acceleration itself, right? This is the acceleration you can write it down as follows. But of course, it's only another expression for the left-hand side. So I'm not interested in, right? I'm rather interested in all source terms on the right-hand side, which means that we should account for all physical accelerations which occur in this case. And well, the first and very common and always present acceleration is the pressure gradient, isn't it? Which means minus 1 over rho times gradient of pressure. It cannot be avoided. Right. Second, well, these are asteroids versus asteroids. And I mentioned the word accumulation, right? It means that self-gravity is extremely important. And I'm going to write the second term, gradient of phi, which is surprisingly complex. And this term is very hard to compute because it's really the self-gravity of the material which is ejected, which is unevenly distributed. It's not a point mass gravity, right? In our previous case, when we discussed the protoplanetary disk, this was really simple because most of the gravity was due to the sun in the center, and it was a point mass-like potential. But this is not point mass-like point mass, right? This is a mass which is distributed in space. Hard to compute. And finally, you know, it's a really solid matter. And we should acknowledge this because forces in a solid matter are sometimes very strong, especially, well maybe not this chalk, but if I take anything else, anything harder, like this piece of metal, right, it's clear that it's hard to bend, it's hard to break, and as a result, we should account for these elastic forces, which are usually written as plus 1 over O and divergence of the stress tensor. Because it's a matrix, I'm going to use these double arrows as a notation, but sometimes it's simply a bold face, or you can write it down simply as a quantity with two indices. If you would like to mix vectorial and index-like notation, it's simply a matrix with two indices. And this is an operator with a single index. And because we have a dot product here, it's simply a sum over all indices of this operator. So this is pressure gradient, or this is gravity, or self-gravity. And these are, this is stress tensor. Actually, well, this is isotropic part of a general stress tensor. This is only a non-diagonal component of the stress tensor, or non-diagonal part. And of course, we will need some. Of course, we will need some expression for it in a minute. I think these are major forces acting in this system. Number three. Well, again, energy equation. Without energies, we will won't able to decide whether any heating mechanisms or friction forces play any role. We need to account for energy equation. And what we should use as a quantity in the energy equation? Well, in this Lagrangian formalism, it's actually better to use internal energy as an independent quantity we are looking for, and It's per unit mass, not per volume, because when you fly away, it's better to keep track of individual masses than of individual volumes, because volumes usually expand when you are ejected. So in terms of units, we shall use joules per kilogram, like this. Well, the Navier-Stokes is commonly used. It's simply meters per second square. And of course, this is d rho over dp, so the units of the continuity are, of course, kilograms per cubic meter per second. Straightforward. But what about this energy equation? So my argument here that we should use the internal energy for du over dt on the left hand side is clear. But then what does it mean for the right hand side of this equation, right? Well, shall we have any expansion here, like in this case? Right? Probably not, because it's joules per kilogram. So if you expand a kilogram, it's still a kilogram, right? As a result, there is no expansion here. But there must be some work and heat. So what are the two important terms here? Minus pressure times divergence on B. This would be for a joules per cubic meter, if I remember well. So I would guess that we should divide by rho to convert it to joules per kilogram, right? Because this is normal work as we know it. And if we divide by rho, we transform to joules per kilogram. And then the heating. In case of a protoplanetary disk, it was, well, a number of terms accounting for irradiation, for viscous heating, etc. What is important here? Well, I think that viscous heating is the most important stuff. And, you know, it's a solid body. So any radiation is kind of shielded, and we are not interested in solar incoming flux. It's really negligible, especially in case of these collisions, which happen really quickly, right? The projectile usually is 5 kilometers per second, so everything happens very quickly, and we need not to account for any slow down heating, but we definitely need to account for a viscous heating. So this work. And the viscous heating, it should be with a plus sign, right? Because it's a deep heating. We usually start with one over rho, usually. And then what it should be proportional to, right? The stress tensor is the one which actually is behind this heating, because you have to overcome these friction or internal friction forces. And we have to multiply all its components, because every single component will contribute to this internal energy. So I'm going to use a double dot product, or in other words, a sum over two or both indices of the stress tensor. And I have to multiply with a gradient of B, which is a gradient of velocities tensor, which is unfortunately not symmetric. And in order to symmetrize this tensor, I'm going to add another gradient on V transposed.
because these are two velocities, I'm going to multiply by 1/2. And as a whole, this tensor is called a tensor of small deformations, but these are velocities. So this is a rate of small deformations. Sometimes in literature, you will find it as epsilon ij, for example, in a different notation. And as a whole, this is viscous heating. Or viscous term.
I will neglect everything else, but you can imagine that, for example, if you heat up something, you will eventually cool it down by radiation. So I can imagine that there can be another plus sign or minus sign, and there are other terms, but we are not going to discuss it this time, because as I said, it's a short time and very quick process of asteroid collisions. So that's the first part of our equation set. Equation of continuity, the Navier-Stokes equation, and the equation for energy. So that's one part of our business. Another part shall be related to the gravity, of course, but I have no space and I have to prepare some space first.
Usually, gravity is included as a Poisson equation. Which means divergence of gradient on phi is equal to the source term of gravity, which is 4 pi rho and g, of course, g rho. However, sometimes it's a bit more straightforward to use a more direct approach. And the direct approach means integrals over volume. So if you are interested in an acceleration, gravitational acceleration, acting on a given point in space or given particle in space, you simply perform a volumetric integral over all particles in your surroundings. Now, of course, this is a possible alternative, but these integrals over volume must be computed for all places in the volume. So this is really time consuming, and we have to use some approximative methods how to evaluate this integral directly. That's something I'm going to describe in the second part of the lecture, but just let me take a note that this is an important approximation, usually by means of a tree code. Tree code means that we approximate distant particles as particle groups, and we only compute a gravity related to its center of mass, right? So essentially distant distributions of particles are taken together and they are computed as a single particle or a small multipole distribution. What's next? Well, usually all these sets must be supplemented by the state equation. Or simply the EOS, However, well, this is not ideal gas. Right? This is a real solid matter, and we should really carefully account for it. So we need P as a function of rho and U. But you know, we start with something total like this. It's a real solid material. And I see essentially, well, regarding the density, I mostly see that when I try to compress this piece of material, it's independent of U. And it creates a horribly large pressure, even though I do not see any decrease in volume, right? Any increase in density. So the first term is really logical. It's rho divided by rho zero, which is unperturbed density, minus one, multiplied with a huge number denoted as A. This is called the bulk modulus. Well, you can hardly imagine that this is true for all possible densities. So it's, again, quite logical to add a quadratic term in terms of this parameter, which is rho divided by rho zero minus one squared. But then what's the final outcome, actually? The final outcome is an expanded material. And I'm afraid that, well, not me, but also not you, you have never seen a rock which was compressed by a half or to a half of its volume, and then the pressure was released. What happens is that such rock is changed to a gas. It simply vaporizes because it expands from a high density state into a low density surroundings, or in this case, vacuum. And this expansion creates simply gas, which is very close to ideal gas. And ideal gas term is simply rho times U. And we only have to multiply by a suitable constant. So let me denote it as A. And finally, because there must be some transition from the solid state to ideal gas state, we have to add one more term, which is, I have to take a note here, which is plus B rho U divided by the following combination. It's U over U zero and ratio of densities squared. Plus one. If the state equation has the following shape, we call it a Tillotson equation. It's taken from a paper by Watson, I think 1962. And in this case, it's a part of the state equation for solid state, not for the fully vaporized rock or for a pure vapor. Because for a pure vapor, we should decrease this and this, of course, because the solid material no longer exists, and we should retain only this and possibly a part of this. So similarly, we have a state equation P as a function of rho and U for vaporized or expanded state. All right, but we are still not yet done, because we miss one important relation for the stress tensor. And this relation is called the constitutive relation. You probably remember our constitutive relation for a liquid, right? For a liquid material, for fluid material like gaseous protoplanetary disk. We had a viscous term which appeared to be, let me recall it. It was a gradient acting on B, right? Multiplied by a constant mu, which we called viscosity, and then we applied another operator, divergence and 1/rho, usually. This was our viscous term previously for liquids, right? But what to do now? Right? Because we have solids. So this is a totally different situation, but this is only a counter example. So let me add CF as compared to this, right? In our case, in solids, there is not a relation between stress and velocity, because in liquids, stress is only present when liquids move against each other. But in our case, and you can verify it using anything, any solid object, including this chart. If you apply a stress, you will create a deformation, and this keeps you in place. When there are no velocities, you can still feel the stress. Right? I can still feel it. So on the left-hand side, we have to use ds over dt, because only then we'll have a relation between the derivative of stress tensor and velocity, or in other words, between stress tensor and coordinates and the deformations. So that's why we use ds over dt on the left hand side, and the right hand side shall be quite similar to our previous case, right? So just let's write it down as a matrix. Yeah. We shall use these gradients of velocities, which means dx, or with respect to x, of vx on the diagonal, and then you have to multiply by some constants of proportionality, right? Which is mu in this case, but that's another point which is probably poorly explained in the lecture notes. This is what was called viscosity in our previous example, right? Because it was related to liquids. Gases which do have a viscosity. In this case, it should have a different dimension, right? Yeah, 1/dt on the left hand side. And so it should be rather called a modulus. In this case, it's a shear modulus, or the Young modulus, which is related to a pure tension or pure compression. So this should be called modulus. Because we deal with solids. So that's my point, that ds over dt should look like this. And it's even possible to maybe to add a few more terms, because there should be again this mu, but multiplied by 1 r, and you have to symmetrize the derivatives, which is d.
In this case, it's dv over dx,
or d, sorry, d with respect to x, and y component plus d with respect to y of vx component. And you can continue, of course, to the right hand side, to the bottom, if you wish. However, these constants should be different for different components of the stress tensor, of course, especially for the for those which are on the diagonal and those which are off diagonal. So let me denote it as this as mu one and this as mu two. And of course, these coefficients are then closely related to measured quantities, which are the bulk modulus. This is one of the quantities which is commonly found in our chemical or mechanical tables. Another modulus which is used in literature is the shear modulus. This is denoted in U. And another quantity is called sometimes E. Or elastic modulus. Or it's included into Hooke law. So it's related to Hooke. And it's also related to tension. And possibly another material constant which might be of interest for us is the so-called cohesion. Let me denote this, for example, C. Because it's related to forces which are related to shear, but at zero pressure, right? When you have essentially only friction between materials which are attached to each other. So this is called cohesion. If you try to separate these materials, this is usually the lowest number, lowest modulus. The bulk modulus is one of the largest, and shear modulus is comparable to the bulk modulus. Because the bulk means related to volume, of course. All right, so that's our initial setup, let me say, how to describe solids by hydrodynamics. And I will pretend it on the blackboard, and I will move on to lecture notes to explain a few other important ingredients of our model. So, you know, these equations are quite general, but they are still not sufficient to describe the behavior of solids. One of the important properties of solids is as follows. I will find out something to demonstrate it. I've got another chart here. Now, it's really easy to break this piece of material. You can even measure, you can even feel yourself how easy is it to break it, right? Not so in compression, but even if you compress the chalk vertically, it will eventually break, right? It's much easier in tension,
right? I will try, but I'm not sure if it's possible. Oh, it's possible, but it took me a while to push it away. But you can break it in tension. And this is a very common behavior for all materials and all rocks, including the rocks which occur in nature and which are related to asteroids. So what we have to do, you know, in this set of equations, there is no fracture and no behavior like this. And we have to account for it, right? Because eventually all rocks break down. So that's my second plot. I will probably write on the blackboard because it's sometimes more clear when you plot it yourself instead of looking at figures. You know, I'm always afraid of looking at figures because looking is totally different from plotting, and it's totally different from understanding, right? These are three really different pieces of knowledge, and sometimes it's really important to do something yourself in order to understand it more clearly. So what I'm talking about is the following plot. It's a relation between stress, now let me denote it as sigma, which is the total stress, or if you focus on non-diagonal components, you can denote it as S if you wish. And deformation on the abscissa. Initially, all materials behave as elastic, and elastic behavior is essentially a linear dependence on this plot. The deformation and sigma and stress are directly proportional. So this is an elastic part. And this tension, it's really described by the Young modulus, and it's a very common quantity you can find in tables. However, there is some upper limit for elastic behavior, and it's the so-called yield, right? Sometimes it's denoted as Y zero, and it's from the English word yield. Or possibly it's related to compliance of the material, right? It will prolong more efficiently because it already doesn't break, but it tends to break. And especially materials which are plastic, like chalk is not plastic at all, but especially plastic materials behave like this. You simply cannot increase stress anymore, and you follow the yield, which creates a plastic deformation. Well, a nice example would be a chewing gum, of course, because you can really feel that the stress is all the time the same, regardless of the length or the size of your deformation. But then eventually the gum will be so tight, so narrow, that it breaks. And this is the end point of this curve, which we call a fracture. What is a fracture? Fracture is based on a presence of dislocations or flaws in a material. And every real material contains a number of different flaws. A flaw is a kind of error in the crystalline structure of the material.
And when you apply a stress, it usually starts at the weakest flaw that you propagate a crack from this flaw across the whole volume, and eventually you create a large scale fracture along which the material breaks down. So this fracture starts as a very small, I mean, microscopic sized flaw, but it can develop by applying the stress into a full scale, macroscopic, visible fracture. And you will eventually see it. You can even study the structure of the fractured material. You can see it actually, how it fractured and whether the fracture is regular or somehow irregular. So you can actually see it very nicely in this case. Right? It's a real full-sized fracture, which is kind of planar, probably related to the overall crystalline structure of chalk, which is possibly very, very regular. And it was probably the weakest flaw in this volume of chalk, which created this large curved fracture. Now, you can see it's a very simplified plot, right? Real materials have more complex behavior. And most importantly, their yield is not, their plastic behavior is not as such, it's not that straight. You can rather imagine that plasticity behaves like this. And then when there is a narrowing or thinnering of material, it again decreases and goes eventually to a fracture as expected. So this is possibly a more typical behavior. And as a result, there is some maximum stress or which you can create in a given material, right? Again, one of the quantities you can find in tables. So now we are ready to describe the respective equations, which we shall use for the description of this stress evolution and stress behavior. So let me show it. First we have to decide when we should switch from perfectly elastic behavior to a plastic behavior. In the simplest model, which is called the von Mises criterion, or here, von Mises is a physicist from the beginning of 20th century, which created the simplest form of equations, of a criterion. You simply compute one scalar quantity based on a sum of stress tensor components. It's called J2 momentum, right? And this J2 is then used in this criterion, in this second equation, right? Where you compare to y or the yield, right? Actually, I used y0 and it's this y, right? And then you limit the stress to this value. So you multiply by this factor, which cannot be larger than 1, corresponding to yield divided by J2. So, okay. So that's one of the simplest models. We also may use a more complicated stress evolution or yield criterion. One of the commonly used criterion is a so-called Drucker-Prager criterion, which is pressure-dependent yield. It means that this y also depends on pressure.
It's not an independent and all the time constant quantity. And it's better, of course, because it accounts for a curved shape of this plot. So that's that's the important addition. And then another behavior, you have to detect and somehow account for the fracturing. So that's what we use here. We introduce a quantity which is called damage. It's a scalar quantity, which is again used to multiply different components of the stress tensor. So that's the prescription we use in our model. If the damage is zero, then essentially nothing happens, right? Everything is multiplied by one. That's fine. But if density approaches one, you simply nullify all non-diagonal components of the stress tensor, as well as pressure, provided it's in expansion, right? If pressure is negative, it means that material is expanding, right? And it's damaged at the same time, then the stress tensor components are zero, simply because damaged material means dust, right? So if I break this chalk into small pieces, then it behaves like a dust, and you can expand dust however you want, to whatever volume you want, and simply there is no negative pressure in this solid. You can expand it easily, effortlessly, but you have to retain this term, which is a pressure during compression. Right? Of course, you cannot compress dust that easily, right? It behaves almost like the original solid. So that's why we retain this term, even for a damaged material. So again, the next question is how to compute damage. No, that's assumption or assuming a certain distribution of flaws. So that's described by the so-called Weibull distribution, which is a simple polynomial, right? The number of flaws which have this activation limit, and it's simply a constant times activation limit to a power of n. And of course, we have some either laboratory materials or possibly also real materials from asteroidal bodies, meteorites, which can be studied to determine by means of laboratory experiments and tension or compression experiments, what is the distribution of these flaws in given materials. I think you can feel it too, that this is the weakest point in our modeling, right? Because knowing flaw distribution in a real asteroid materials, original, which are located on bodies themselves, this is the key to understand what is going on, right? Of course, we use some analogs from laboratory measurements, but we cannot guarantee that these are indeed the same, from the mechanical point of view, the same materials as on asteroidal bodies. And eventually, what you can find out in Benz and Ospo 1994 is this evolutionary equation for damage. Damage essentially may increase in the course of time, provided that deformations are large enough to start a flaw at which can be activated at a given stress. So that's essentially the meaning of this evolutionary equation for damage. All right, so we are actually ready because we have all physics summarized. and prepared for a numerical solution. And now, in the remaining time, I'm going to describe the numerical solution of this equation set. So in Czech, it's called hlazená částicová metoda. In English, it's the smooth or smoothed particle hydrodynamics. We simply imagine that the medium, the continuum, is described by individual particles. However, we still need continuous functions. And how you can relate individual particles to a continuous function describing the solid matter, right? So that's the key to understand. So my point is the following. So I would like to use a set of particles which are plotted on this view graph, but particles are not point-like. You cannot assign density to a point-like object, right? These are volumetric objects, and they are even diffused somehow because they allow you to compute a value of density or any other quantity from our equation set in a continuous manner for every point in space. But you have to, of course, you have to combine in a wise way values from individual particles somehow. And that's the point of the SPH method. So let me introduce it as follows. First, we have this equation, which is essentially a definition of the delta distribution, or simply speaking, delta function, right? We express, in this case, we express the velocity vector as a function of r, as an integral over the whole volume, omega, v as a function of r dash, multiplied by a delta function and r minus r dash d omega, which is a kind of nonsense, right? You need a single value for a given point r, a single vector value, but inside this integral, you use all the values in the whole space, and you simply pick up a single one, right? So this is kind of useless, but we are going to use an approximation for a delta function, right? This is a precise definition, but delta is non-zero only in a single point in space. I think there is a misprint in this equation actually, because it does not depend on h, which is a quantity which is not yet needed, right? I think it's worth to use this h here in this approximation, because this approximation tells you that it's the same as before, but instead of the delta function, we use another function, which is a so-called kernel. It's no longer a spike at a given point in space. It's a very smooth function and smoothly increasing and decreasing function called the kernel. It depends on the relative distance between the vectors, and a so-called smoothing length denoted as h. This smoothing length is an important parameter of the model. Of course, you can have a high resolution model and low resolution model, but of course, this h, this distance in space, should include some neighboring particles, because neighboring particles will tell you what is the gradient or divergence or eventually rotation, if you would need it, in your surroundings. So that's the reason why we include some non-zero age in the vicinity of your point. Okay, and now we can actually try to express some non-trivial case, which is here, a computation of a divergence of a vector. Actually, this is the first term on the right-hand side of the continuity equation, right? So this is really very useful stuff. So I will use it as a new function. So I will simply put it inside this integral. And this is essentially one-to-one correspondence to the previous equation. But then what we can do is to express this as a divergence of this multiplication minus the value of the function times the gradient acting on the kernel. Right? It's actually the integration like per partes, and this is the same equivalence. So that if we apply divergence, you have to do it as a multiplication, so that act on a every single term, the first one and the second one. But if you subtract the second one, you will end up with the first one. So that's why is it equivalent. But then a very important point is the following, right? If this W has a compact support, I mean, its extent, its a range of non-zero values is limited, then you can compute the first integral. You can express it as the integral over the surface of the boundary of the volume, but at the boundary, the value of kernel is zero. If your volume you integrate over and its boundary you integrate over right now is large enough to be larger than the kernel itself, its support itself, you can say that the first integral is zero, and you are left with the second integral only, and there is only some what is the operation in the last? I see it's a derivative with respect to r instead a derivative with respect to r dash, but it's a very minor change. I think the key is that we can express all derivatives of all quantities with help of the values of functions, this part, this part, multiplied by gradients of kernels, which is this part. And this is the key to understand, the key of the SPH method, because you never compute any derivatives of any quantities. You simply pre-compute in advance derivatives of your kernels, and then you simply perform an integral, or in discrete form, it will be a sum over all neighboring, relatively close neighboring particles. And that's it, right? That's the key of the SPH method. So that's my point, that SPH is really useful. Now we have to discretize the integral, because integral is acting on continuous functions, but we are going to compute it as follows. It's only a sum over neighboring particles, where d omega, this volume element, is simply m over j, a mass assigned to a particle divided by rho assigned to a particle u sum over. So I think that's fine, but we are left with a following question. This is a spatial discretization. The temporal discretization remains the same as before. It's essentially a discretization we used in the past for other stuff. It's an Euler-like discretization for densities. And if we are going to use an explicit scheme, then it's simple because you simply express these new densities with help of old densities and these old densities multiplied by a divergence of velocity field. So that's essentially trivial, right? And you only have to sum over neighbors. So sort of sub-problem is to efficiently find neighbors, closely neighboring particles. So that's very important ingredient of the model, and I'm going to describe it in a minute. So I think this is the same stuff, but related to pressure. Not surprisingly, it leads to essentially the same result, but in this case, it's not a vectorial quantity and it's not a divergence, it's simply a gradient of pressure. But you will end up again with a gradient acting on kernel itself. I think it's more interesting right now to understand how these kernels should look like. And that's my next point. So what about these kernels? Kernels should look like as follows, right? This is one and very common example of a kernel function. It's a distance. In this case, it's denoted as capital R, which is small r divided by h. It's a spherically symmetric function. So we only deal with a distance as a scalar quantity. It's not an anisotropic kernel. And then it's a combination of, well, two or three polynomials, but the third one is simply zero. And these polynomials have the following properties. They are smooth, so they have higher order derivatives, easily computed. They are easy to compute because we will need them, right? For sure, the first ones, and for other problems, even the second derivatives might be useful for you. And then you must have a compact support. That's why there is zero for distances larger than one, or r over h larger than one, because otherwise you will have to sum over all particles in the whole space, which is nonsense. It is much better to use a compact support and sum over a limited subset of particles. And this is the derivative of the kernel. And I think there should be an image. it resembles quite closely an exponential function, which seems to be like this. But exponentials are useless because their values are non-zero at large distances. And so it's a useless function because it does not have a compact support. So this is, I think, a major part of this lecture, but we should probably understand a few more aspects of these computations. So I think this is not so important, but we should probably discuss some, usually we should discuss initial and boundary conditions. In this case, it's simplified because initial conditions are simply some objects that might be spheres. If you imagine that everything in the universe is sphere, you can start with spheres. But these days, we should probably start with real shapes of real asteroids because they are definitely not spherical, as shown, as demonstrated clearly by adaptive optics observations, by light curves and radar observations. But in terms of initial conditions for these simulations, you have to start with a set of particles. And quite often, we use a so-called hexagonal packing. It's a distribution of particles, which if plotted as spheres, they are attached next to each other in a hexagonal way. And you simply compute a triple four cycle over the volume, and you check whether you fulfill a condition that you are inside your body. In this case, if you are inside the sphere. If true, you can include this particle. If not, you do not generate anything. So this way, you can generate essentially any shape, not only sphere. But then you should distinguish target and projectile, and you assign some non-zero velocities to the projectile. You can eventually transform to a barycentric frame so that all these particles move against each other. And then if you run a simulation, you will usually see something like this. It's actually in this case, it's a small size impact. It's only a kilometer size body. And it was hit by a very small projectile. It was composed by many tens or even hundreds of particles, but it's a very small sized impact. You know, these kilometer sized bodies are essentially the weakest or close to the weakest bodies in the solar system. So it's sufficient to strike them even with this small projectile because they break very easily, and because they have very low gravity, self-gravity, they disperse also very easily. So this is the so-called fragmentation phase, fragmentation part of the simulation, which is computed by Hydro, by the SPH. You can see that the body has some velocity field. What you probably did not see very clearly, that there is some shock wave going through the body, because the projectile is very fast. But what you can see here is a propagation of damage. You know, this is a case of a partially damaged object, so that most or bulk of its volume remains undamaged. But there are some places denoted by yellow color, which show the scalar damage. So especially the impact point and its surroundings is fully damaged. I think that in this is an older simulation, and I think we had some problems with the very center of the body, because I think this damage in the center is a kind of artificial. It's not a real physical behavior, because we had, I think, some decompression wave going on within the body. But for the later phases, we should use a simplified approach, because you know, you need to compute orbital evolution of these objects, of these fragments, until let's say at least 1, 2, or 3 days, because that's the typical time scale at which they leave the Hill sphere. And so it means they will never return, and they will never re-accrete, unless you will wait several heliocentric orbits, right? Of course, if you eject something to a vicinity, then you have a non-zero chance that you will be hit again a few orbits later, right? That's the typical case for near-Earth asteroids, especially potentially hazardous objects. But in this case, we compute the gravitational accumulation by means of a n-body code. In this case, it's called Piketty graph. And what you can see is that these kilometer-sized objects re-accrete, well, partially, especially at the very beginning, right? You have ejecta, which fly on ballistic trajectories, and they often fall back onto the body itself. So it's a partially accreted object. But of course, there are some distant ejecta which fly away, and eventually they will end up, I think the Hill sphere is something like 1,000 kilometers far from the center. So that's one option. If you would like to perform these simulations yourself, I think you can also think of our new code, which was made available by Pavel Ševeček, our former PhD student. So let me just briefly demonstrate what the code is capable of, because I use it these days to model Calliope and Linus. I think one nice demonstration might be this giant impact corresponding to a Hygieia family. It was a really big big event, which was a destruction of a 400 kilometer parent body, which was re-accreted very quickly. But during the re-accretion, it oscillated somehow. And you probably have seen that the body is not perfectly spherical, but it oscillated like this, like a fluid ball. And we think that during this re-accretion, the sound waves must have changed the rheology of the object, that the initial oscillations, I mean, these oscillations on a essentially, especially this one, must be partly retained in the currently observed shape. It's not possible if everything is damaged, right? Using a simplified rheology, I mean, damaged down to D equals one, means that everything is fluid. And fluid means that it flows like water, like viscid water, and it would create a body which is too spherical compared to the observed asteroid number 10 Hygieia. So that's why we think that we should use a more complex rheology, and especially the so-called acoustic fluidization, which is a process related to a sound waves which propagate within the body in the center. And if they are present, these sound waves, you can imagine it as moving rock by sound waves propagating through the medium, which makes them partially fluid, especially during the decompression phase of the sound wave. So that was a brief demonstration or visualization, but if you would like to use the code yourself, I prepared one simplified simulation consisting of only 10,000 particles. You can use a graphical user interface to set up your simulation. And sometimes it's really useful if you would like to combine individual pieces of the code. Sometimes it's really very efficient to use this graphical interface because it saves a lot of time to set up your simulation. So I think Pavel is very capable in this implementation of everything in C++. So what you can see here is a simulation of an impact into a differentiated body. So I created a primary with this piece of code. But of course, I had to carefully think what input materials shall I use. So I used first a shape, a spherical shape for the mantle. And for this spherical shape, I used a basaltic material with 3 grams per cubic centimeter. And I had to carefully set up all these quantities. And I also had to check out in tables whether this is a material I'm interested in. Another possibility is another component is a core, which is smaller radius and composed of iron. So again, I had to check out whether these iron quantities are reasonable ones. especially I think that was that will be corrected in a later model, these viable exponent and coefficient are set up incorrectly in this particular simulation. If you would like to check out what is going on, you can evaluate or you can start this node, and you can see how this body was created. You can see it's a simplified hexagonal packing. You can zoom it in or zoom out, and you can, well, initially the velocities are zero, so this is not a very interesting quantity, but if you would like, for example, see densities, and you can verify that it's indeed a differentiated body, then let's do it. Okay, it is, right? It's composed of two parts, and what I show here is a narrow slice, just to see all the layers and all the particles which are present in this simulation. Of course, you can also plot the whole body if you are interested in. In this case, the body is partially transparent because I plotted the particles as small dots. If you increase the sizes of particles, of course, it fills the whole volume. And you should you should always think of these simulations as simulating a continuum, not a set of particles, because just please recall how the SPH works, right? It's a continuous function described by a combination of values of all particles in the surroundings. So it's not a set of particles, essentially. It's a continuum, which we describe here. So you can set up your simulation this way. And in this case, as you can see, I stabilized the primary, I prepared an impactor, I combined the two bodies together. They are running at six kilometers per second against each other. And then I have a fragmentation, which is an SPH run, a handoff to an N-body integrator, and accumulation, which is called separately by means of Barnes Hutt algorithm, which I'm going to describe next week. Finally, let me show how you can study the results. Well, I'm not very interested in stabilization run, but what I can open here is a fragmentation run. I have to set up my visualization tool correctly. And what you can see on this simplified and very low resolution run is a propagation of the shockwave very easily. It's 6 kilometers per second, so it's essentially a matter of a few seconds until you propagate across your target. Then you can study its shape. In this case, the original spherical distribution of particles is not changed very much because it was a small cratering event. But you know, this is just for test purposes. If you prolong this simulation until, let's say, 1,000 seconds, not 100 seconds, you will see a substantial changes in the shape of the whole target. And you can find some very interesting redistribution of particles across the surface of the body. And that's what I'm interested in, because what we guess from the measured value of density for Calliope is that it has a large metallic core or iron core, and this iron core should affect a final shape of the target. So that's my goal, and I hope that next week or possibly just after Christmas we will have some results related to to this scientifically interesting problem. All right, it's 17:10, so we are almost 2 minutes late. If you have any questions or comments, please do not hesitate to ask. Or we can, of course, discuss later on if you are, let's say, a bit shy, asking in a wide audience. But anyway, thank you very much for your attention, and see you next week. Possibly the lecture will be already in Troja, but we will see next week.